Thank you, Jacob. We'll return the hearing, Ms. Stabler, here for Ms. Beresford and Captain Bryant. Mr. Stanchel, thank you for bringing it forward, making your team available. I love your early report, having absorbed a number of submissions, a number of descriptions, emphasizing the summaries. We would start early because from hell or high water, this is our last day.
Okay, so
I want to play the game by lunchtime. Correct. We have one split up to call you at 4 o'clock. In short, if we could create as much this time as possible to get your senior ministers propped up just to go to the hospital, a lot of work in the room. And there are some clear problems with this different notes.
Before we start, I filed my information and I wasn't intending to read those. I was hoping I'd actually be taken to the
That would indeed be our request. We have read your legal submission. I have some points I'd like to discuss with you.
Yes.
But if you'd like to put in a highlights package at all this type of word and start straight at questions, that are your option.
Yes, right. Okay. So, if we can, if you just want an introduction to my team, I'm Chris Stephen, and I'm Tom Bell for Michael Beresford.
And
Dan
Beresford from my team.
And I'm Chris
Beresford, welcome.
Thank you. Rob Beckley, I'm refreshed. And I'm going to go on to TDG, if that means
anything. William Field, my co-founder, Dan Moss.
And the goal of the field together
there?
Yeah.
In light of the council submissions in my submission page 16.
18. And so, and that's why I call especially you.
Yes, thank you. Of course, we can.
I haven't given you the cases, so I can give them to you. I can send them to you electronically, but I've referred to a number of cases. Obviously, we've got the Privy Council case from Hawaii. And then I referred to some pretty significant cases in an RMA context, but I think Judge York's decision in Buchanan was a case that I think is much more than just the issues here. It was a case where Iwi had strong Nigella over part of the coastal area, and they were proposing a marine farm. And they were being actively opposed by stock because it was regarded as being inappropriate development in a coastal area. So, you know, the section 6 and section 8 issues sort of head on and so on up here.
Well, I had the opportunity to hear your presentation because something that's been on my mind. We'd like to finish your opening comments and then we'll go back to the
Well, so that's really what I wanted to say here. So really just I say that the beliefs that Mr. Beresford is keeping here go now to access protection. Through the plan provisions. Of the beneficiary's interest in this nuclear land. And advance of the economic building, which was the intent to the economic. So that's really all I ever want to say.
That's helpful, thank you. Do I take the over submission? There's a few points I want to clarify. First is paragraph 67, which I was obviously missing something because they appear to contradict each other.
Well, what I'm saying is that it's a package. The offer to make the land available for the RML land available for the rural land, as you say, for recreational activities. There's a quid pro quo to get his government rights. So what Mr. Beresford wouldn't want is recognition of the potential recreation use of the rural land through the plan provisions without any legal extra zoning on the common position.
Well, it's fair to say your position for Mr. Beresford is that recreational use of land currently on a grace and favour basis.
Absolutely.
And that will remain the position at least until, as you say, the package is approved.
Yes,
correct.
And that's
correct. I think the contradiction, if I understood that point, the contradiction I detected, possible contradiction, you said the submit is not contesting the RML, is that an absolute position, or is that dependent on the package too?
No, it's not. It started off on the footing that this whole block of land was intended for the economic sustenance to be beneficiaries, to be benefits. But in recognition of the fact that some of it is just not suited to any development, and that is the owner, it's just too steep and rocky. So they prepared to get away. Because it's not suited to any form of zone. So that was my own.
Yes. Patricia, quite appropriate was Hessen being with you. I was a little puzzled when George Gaston's mission was that the childhood conclusions contributed to the case you advanced. It's very useful, it was very interesting. But what I couldn't figure out was how the conclusion that the gap in dwelling provision for dwelling lay in the attached and high density development. It's not exactly the same thing as affordable development, as we know you can get very expensive apartments, but it's almost code as language for affordable development. And so I couldn't see how that fitted with the case that you're advancing. And now it's become a little clearer because with the response to the end of the summary of each last night, it's got a more general critique of Scotland's efforts. But going back to where she started, where does that fit into the case you've got?
Well, it's really just, and I'll leave this to intentionally for Beck to explain, the provision of these additional 150 houses is just going to enable or contribute to the buffer for the medium to long term, rather than trial and water. And I think the Chancellor would take the view that it might even go some way towards meeting sort of an aspect of the market that sort of might prefer being in the locality. But I'll leave it to her to describe, but it's really to the extent that this can is going to sort of give effects to the end use. And we say that it's going to contribute to that buffer.
You understand that, well, I hesitate to say every submitter seeking an upzoning in this case.
Yes, I've got to say that.
You're going to have made that submission.
Yes.
But that, not all with the technical backup that you have.
No.
Now, you asked, of course, if you could be put back in the hearing order to the end, to as close to the end as possible. I think you managed to provide that in order that you could hopefully advance discussions with the Crown regarding land. What's the current state of the nation?
Yeah, well, I think it's very good to explain that. But the state of the nation is that that's been actively worked on during the discussions underway with the Crown. It's very good to sort of speak to that, but the problem hasn't been solved yet, but it's sort of the move of what. I think that perhaps I might leave it to Ms.
Happy to be the first of the country.
Yeah. It was probably very, very ambitious thinking that we could get it resolved within this time frame, but that's not to say that it's capable of being resolved.
Probably fair to say that I thought it was an ambitious thing, but I was happy to give you the chance. So Ms. Gerson, if I forget to ask you, we could just say first, being pleasure and something you could assist me, but I've asked another councillor during the course of this hearing, in paragraph 18, what is the difference between more suitable and more superior? I know that's from Ration Transfer, but I've never understood it.
Yes, okay. So I think more suitable, this is an inquiry into the relative merits of the competing zones, that's thought by Mr. Gerson and that in the status quo, which is what the council's seeking to maintain. And so more appropriate or more suitable invites that to the comparison of what is better, although the test isn't much better, as opposed to what is the more superior, which is sort of an objective sort of criteria which might not involve either of these the competing proposals in front of us that we make.
So is it the difference between the quality and the quantity?
Yes, yes it is.
Other councillors have submitted vociferously that our section 32 obligations in effect to consider even any zone we can think of between that which is sought and the status quo. Do you agree with that, I presume?
Yes.
Express permission of effective landowners is not required. Obviously, there are over 1,000 of them, not all of which you even know where they are. That would be completely impractical. But should we have confidence that Acacia Basin is the rest that represents at least a majority of you?
You can ask the spirit of the team. I don't even know if you need to know that. I've been involved in many cases where a rezoning proposal has been proposed by a developer in respect of land that the developer has no interest in that and has successively purchased the land once the rezoning was successful. And the Belfast, the notorious 293 Belfast, 93 hectare block of land where we were on court for about 2 years, that was the case in point. The developer didn't own any of the land when that was first mooted, and in that case, the court held that that was irrelevant. And whether or not there is a majority, I very much doubt that that's the case. The working group is the group that reports back to the working group and the OGS on what they can do. The reality is that unless all of the 1,057 beneficiaries agree to actually take advantage of the information that is given to them under the plan, it won't go ahead. So ultimately they'll have to all agree. So it's relevant for the purpose of this hearing that they might not know that now it's impractical.
The point that's set me off on this chain of control is that of course I accept your funding proposition, but you don't need an interest in land to make a submission either on a residence consent or a zoning application. But where the rezoning, as it is in this case, has the potential to constrain the options open to the landowner, that gives me pause. And the constraint I have in question, something I've discussed with Mr. Crystal, which is if there was one of the options that suggests the council is continuing to forest the land, that has obvious practical issues quite apart from the provisions in the plan that are seeking to eliminate wild and pines as a major environmental issue. But if it's an LDR zone, effectively precludes forestry, does that mean that that should be an exception to that general principle?
Yes, like we were talking about that this morning actually, but and it's a good thing to me that even though we've asked for a rural residential for a residential zone of the land, which the practical effect of this is that any development might be equivalent to that occurs until all the other triggers occur, i.e. we've got someone to take the balance of the land for reserve purposes. Probably to overcome
the constraint having immediate effect, the constraint on forestry, as a first zone, might be a more appropriate method for achieving the same outcome, but effectively it their constraint would then operate because you have a continuation of the rural zoning. It's not what was thought, it's not what was thought, but it would be a way of getting around that if you thought that was a problem. The second thing is that, and this is the reason why Mr. Critical has asked for forestry to meet the need for permitted activity under the residential zoning, which is a curious request for relief, but the reasons for that are twofold. It was, again, overcome that constraint, but obviously if the residential development opportunities were to be taken advantage of, you have to be able to clear the land, and if you had a prohibited sort of forestry with the river, you couldn't do it, it would frustrate the opponent. So you have to deal with the issue whichever way you go.
Well, that of course, you follow the trail of my inquiry exactly, and I will move to the next stage of asking myself, given that this special sort of ball, LGR zone, whether a change to make forestry in that zone permitted is within the scope of the submission.
Well, I would actually put it into the category of a consequential change, because without it, the residential zoning is frustrated. If you can't harvest the land of the trees, and harvesting is within the definition of forestry, you won't be able to clear the land for development. And so if I say it sort of follows that you have to make that consequential amendment and address forestry in some way, just for matter of harvesting.
Okay, I suppose that would be your argument, but I do need to have you on the record.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that where that takes us is, yes, a permitted activity appropriate?
Probably not, because it's a more generous activity status than is given to forestry in any other zone, but you also wouldn't want, I'll say that with a caveat, and that's that you wouldn't want the prospect of harvesting at any other time, because again that might frustrate. So I would say possibly controlled, and that's a little bit more surety that you'll be able to achieve clear the land of the developer, but in a way that's controlled, with matters controlled in relation to, you know, the formation of access and good case and all this stuff.
But I voice the concern that it's been rolling around in my mind that all of your witnesses can ponder it and address it as they come up. It seems to me that the existence of all of those trees on that land, surrounded on three sides by residential land, raises obvious questions as to how you get trees out. And while I know you're working on access, the concept of large logging trucks traveling through the North Lake residential area, where it is rapidly becoming, may of course be pause in terms of the potential adverse effects of the clearance of the timber by your submission to support. Picked up on the point that I discussed with Mr. Barr. If you can't clear the forest, and Mr. Greenwood confirms that there is no economic use for the trees in situ, is this a complete snooker? And I don't know what the answer to that is, but I appreciate your assistance, because as you say, I can understand completely, for an applicant, you wouldn't want possibly the tree clearance being declined, but in that environment, with, as I say, the residential uses on three sides, seems to be decidedly problematic to think that you could successfully remove the trees unless you chop them out.
Yes, if you report about the area of forest that would be on the land that would be developed, that would be the period of time taken to get it, and I think Chris will not get correct on this, but we were talking about this morning as well, and it would be short term, it would only be a matter of weeks. You know, forestry is an ongoing activity, you know, so that might be cause for concern, but if it's just for the purpose of care, to make local development, would be sort of a one-off occurrence, and it would be short-term effects, which would have to be managed, you know, it would be, I mean, I know this is a big issue for up in Clinton as well, you'd have to manage it by sort of limiting stuff on the 2 day or whatever.
Yeah, I suppose coming back to my point about scope, given that this aspect wasn't flagged in the submission, we have a natural justice point that the owners of Northlake might have quite a lot to contribute to the discussion about what is or is not appropriate in a short term of this.
Yeah, but I don't think so, because, and I'll deal with it in this way. Firstly, it was implicit in the original submission that was notified, which sought to rezone the entire block, that if that was successful, the trees would go, and they'd have to be removed somehow. You know, anyone looking at that submission, they would, I might have been sort of wondering how that could happen because the land was landlocked. But that's a really good forest conservation. It's because of the fact that the land is landlocked and that to overcome that problem is going to be necessary in some negotiations with a landowner, but your concerns can be overcome because that is going to have to be on the basis that we need this land to provide access for development and obviously for a clearance of the forest.
Okay.
So it's going to be in a commercial context that those concerns will be overcome.
Now, in terms of the discussion of the development potential at the time of settlement, we're discussing about particularly sterile, I can say what the Crown did or may or should anticipate in 1998. And they did or they didn't, but they didn't know 20 years ago, and how are you going to know anyway? The thing that occurred to me is that although there's no O&L line on the plan, even then, what is now the OGP, maybe not in 1998, but certainly soon after 1998, with the first of Judge Jackson's decisions on what is now the ODP, instituted a process in the ODP where there are no firm lines in there. There are definitive lines in some places.
Yes, and there's a requirement to address it on a
case-to-case basis. But the ODP is built on the fact that when something comes up, an assessment is made as to whether it's an O&L and the which, if the argument is yes, it then triggers the panoply of assessment criteria in the ODP. So, is it really material that it wasn't aligned on the map?
Well, I say yes, and firstly, my understanding of the background is that the land was picked by the Department of Land and Survey in 1997, and then there was a valuation process before it was agreed in 1998 to be the settlement land. At that stage, the channel was an operative document. It didn't become operative until about 2000, I don't think. And I don't even know whether all of those provisions were even included in the plan at that point, or if they were, they were operative. I don't know what the form of them was, but I do know that there was also some debate. I recall reading a decision of Judge Jackson's, and I can't remember which one it was. It might have been an infinity case where the court was debating whether those provisions, and this was at a time when the plan was operative. through to those provisions will actually trigger on the part of the request for plan change. So, but the court went through what the award is about, the court went through that process in the case for the genius. So I can't, and I think I've said that in my submission, I just can't say for sure that those provisions were in the plan at the time of the end. And I ended up to find a version of the plan that was, of course, in
1992-1998.
Because I think
it's a pretty sterile...
It is a sterile argument, yes.
But another way to look at it would be the Crown may not have appreciated it, but I think that the stress of my jaws used to what the Crown did or did not appreciate through the negotiations. But in terms of stepping back, the RMA clearly required consideration of the land or part of the land as an ODL.
Yeah, so and if it did, then chances are would have come up the same lines now. And I don't think you can be too much truth on that for the very pragmatic reason that, and as I say in my submission, the land that is to be retained, O&M, with the exception that 4 hectare block where development rights have been sought, is not suited to development. Even speculating what the Crown might have been done, what the Crown might have done about it, they might have even still taken the block on the basis that there was development opportunity for the balance of the land, which is the basis for the case for Nanny Logan.
And of course.
And or I could have been pictured purely for forestry potential, because bear in mind that all of the land around it was rural zoned, and so forestry would have been more feasible.
And yeah, I suppose how many of it's relevant, but of course the net is with ODL too.
Well, yes, the strength of it would have applied. I mean, it might be classified as an ODL now, and it might not be at the time, and I don't know whether it was.
Well, I think before the operative plan.
There were no ODLs, just a
requirement. Well, there were no ODLs in place in the plan.
No.
Section 16 is considered to exist. And it would be a heroic landscape architect that would suggest that the net is not enough for any natural
resources. The only difference is that if the Crown hadn't alienated that land under a passable list, had that been given to the beneficiaries and then it was laid down with being no use to them, they would have had the ability to substitute that land through these non-title claim settlement at provisions, whereas because this is substitute land already, they're stuck with it.
Only one by the chair.
Yep. So that is the difference.
Yes. In terms of the discussion of Section 85, the section obviously says that you can take the Section 85 point in a submission or a subsequent application to the court.
I'm going to know if I can go and not do that.
Yes, I know. That's why I'm not going to discuss with you the end of the article that section requires. But it occurs to me that while the given the submission didn't raise the Section 85 point, that is a matter of background rather than something that might bear directly on our recommendations to the government. That's my initial impression, and that you think that's wrong and funny.
Yeah, you could be right there. I don't think that it matters that section 85, the section's not cited. The section itself is not cited in the submission. It's really sort of where the basis of the original submission. And I accept your point that the ground for the rezoning proposal was that the land was no longer suited for rural activities. Whether that's announced through a with a rural zoning was not capable of any reasonable use. I would say it's coming pretty close to the sort of section there. But I guess the point is that in the context of a section 32 context, it's a useful benchmark as well. And particularly in the context of section 5, with the overall judgment under section 5, and considering the competing zoning, that is a useful benchmark. But it has to be, surely, whether the land is capable of reasonable use, has to sort of go to the question of whether that's a design that's going to need those sort of things, economic and social and cultural needs of those beneficiaries.
Well,
and the community.
Yeah,
it's a sort of
cost and
benefits. Yes, it is. And so, in that context.
In terms of your argument under 51.1, the genesis of this land to the personal circumstances of the applicant, given that you've made a strong case that that these matters arise under section 8.
Mm.
Is it double counting to consider it in this part in personal circumstances of the applicants as well?
Well, personal circumstances, I'm not sure I follow how they could be regarded as separate things that could amount to double counting. It's the personal circumstances of the beneficiaries as successors to the original the beneficiaries are entitled to the economic use of this land as successors. I'm not sure whether reference to the personal circumstances or something different comes when you get that from my position.
Right.
I see it as the same.
Well, maybe this is we're the same way, but the way you said it was the same thing.
Yes. They are standing in the shoes of the original purchaser, the other successors. And they have the same rights. As the original particular man, as it was saying.
Now, in terms of the juxtaposition between section 85 and section 6.
Section 85?
Section 85. I'm looking here at your paragraph 52. We have now, before you arrive, Mr. Page would make the submission to me on the significance of the appeals decision in the Man of War, setting protection of an OIL and the environmental bottom line, independent of the use of CPS. And of course, we're required to recognise and provide for that protection on Section 17. I think the thrust of Mr. Page's submission was But if a life offender is more thought to be the law prior to the settlement of that of war, about the availability of trade-offs and overall judgments, that's no longer the position. And given that that's fresh in my mind, I invite your comment. Do you think that's wrong?
Well, a couple of different conflicts in there. Firstly, the man of war, I understand, is sort of the proposition that if the land qualifies as an RNL, it's possibly protected as an RNL, irrespective of the consequences to the landowner in terms of their ability to use the land. Is that the point?
That's
the point. Yes, and so that's where objection, sort of the potential tension in Section 85 would come up. But I say that it's not so much the tension between Section 85 and Section 6, it's really the tension between Section 6 and Section 8. The ability to sort of overcome unreasonable abuse is based upon Section 8, and this is a positive protection of the Bluegrass land for the economic with the balance of the beneficiaries. So I say that that's must run Section 8. So we've got a continued tension between Section 8 and 5. And then looking at it from the King's Standard perspective, and also going back to Man of War, firstly that was in a coastal sort of coastal environment, and so there's different values. What we've got here is outstanding natural landscapes and the requirements prevent them from protecting from inappropriate development. Our case would be that this is not an appropriate development of land within the RNL. And so there is a question over the extent to which the RNL values are compromised, if they are not. And if there is any tension between Section 6 and 8 in this overall judgment, then in light of the two standard approach, you sort of either don't have enough permissions. You can still have resorts in Part 2 and this overall judgment where there is incomplete coverage of the subject matter, you know, the Part 2 matters, in the relevant plan provisions, and I would address that in my submissions and said that there is incomplete coverage.
I think the particular point that I was discussing in this page before you arrived was that the Court of Appeals recently was not limited to the application of the NZCPS because the ONL extended beyond the coastal environment.
That's right. But I think my point is that the grounds for rejecting the ONL in that case weren't based on Section 8 matters, so the court wasn't considering a contest between Section 6 and Section 8.
Well,
I think that arises in this case. And you have to bear in mind that Section 6 through 8 are for the principles that are for the purpose of achieving Section 5.
To that such thing, is that tension resolved by the difference in the initial instruction between recognise and provide for where you have regard to?
No, that gives an indication of a hierarchy. But, and I think I've addressed this in my, it's not a fixed hierarchy, and there's a principle of proportionality might apply. So what I say is that it's not correct that Section 8 can never come by Section 6. Or, you know, it's not a rigid sort of hierarchy of values where Section 6 must always prevail over Section 7 or 8 values. It doesn't work that way. And I've referred to in my submissions a case where the court, well, a couple of cases where the court has taken a different approach and they've referred to the principle of proportionality. Look at the sort of a, and this is why I say you've got to look at the extent to which these Section 6 values were compromised in relation to that small 4 hectare block of land where the government lines are going to fall. in comparison to the enhancement to the beneficiary in the protection of their customers with the consumer protection act. So there are special things in terms of what you can give higher weight to section 8 values. And so I say that we're meeting that section 6 regardless because of the manner in which the ONLBs are supposed to be managed through the control of the
moving on to your discussion of these covenants, which is very interesting. I suppose that clearly they don't involve use of coastal marine resources, which were a shoulder of the title, not the relevant deal. This, of course, is not a cultural site, as I said, I would want to discuss that further with Mr. Beresford. But the thought that occurred to me is, how far does this principle go? And to give you a concrete example, I sat on the panel in stream one of this hearing process from the request by Kamatoa Maitahu from Otago South Coast. And I asked them, because the provisions that they talk about most are the rights, values and interests. Whether those rights, values and interests extended to the economic success of the child of
Jeff.
How far does that principle go?
Well, I think it's important to go that far. And the significance of this land is that it was settlement land. It was given to them as settlement land for the purpose of addressing a claim under the Treaty of Waitangi, for breach of the Treaty of Waitangi. And so it very definitely triggers Section 8. And so even though it was had cultural values, it was land given to them in substitute for the British cultural value. As part of the settlement. And so I think that it's not too remote that Section 8 is definitely engaged in the Section 60 and 78. And so you can, I don't remember if the court case has gone mana whenua over the resources. But the court didn't come to its conclusion that Section 8 values are actively protected because of that Section 6 linkage. It was purely because it actively protected their interest in the resource in question. I'm not sure that it was necessarily time to sort of cultural values.
Might well be right. And I think we're, you're on all fours with the council team. Who I think accept that this is a Section 8 case and kind of state a clear understanding to us that it's not a Section 16 case. Can I go to your paragraph 82? That you're quoting here the, when we talk about Kaitahu and Maitahu, who are we talking about? The implication of your submission is that Mr. Beresford and the other 1,000 whatever descendants of the original 57 named people are Kaitahu for this purpose.
Yes, and Kaitahu is just a Otago dialect for Kaitahu. And the original 57 were for the most part Maitahu. And that's as much as as I know, based on historical documents. And so it necessarily follows that the beneficiaries are sort of for the most part my patent. In terms of the Waitaki clan children, whether they all come from the umbrella of people that are described in that, I can't answer that or really think what they do, but for the most part they have to be together.
Well, I'm sure that it's like happy to say that, but my point is a little different. It is when provisions like this refer to Waitaki or Waitaki, are they talking about members of the iwi, which might be some or all of the members, or the members collectively of Waitaki and the Trog Act says that Trog is the representative of the collective? That's where I'm coming from. Like, are these provisions triggered by some subset of Waitaki, and is that consistent with the Trog Act?
I can't answer that question.
And it appeared to me that they all refer to Waitaki collectively.
Oh, I think they have to refer to Waitaki collectively, yes.
And that we should interpret plan provisions in the same way.
You don't have to, yeah, but you have to, the plan provisions refer to the principles of treaty of Waitaki, as well as Waitaki status of the treaty. Partner, so it's not just limited to the Waitaki interest in a collective sense. But it's broader than that, and where it references the principle of inclusion by changes in sectional obligations.
Just like a holiday. Is the extended and interesting discussion of the plan provisions ultimately a red herring, given that it doesn't appear to be in dispute that this is an appropriate case to have regard to Section 8?
Yes, I think so. We don't need to resolve the problem. I think if you just straight to Section 8, I could have dealt with the issue of my commission in that way, but we don't need to resolve the question. I mean, if they are just confined to the cultural issues, it's no. And so I think in any case in this context where we're dealing with proposed provisions, you can have the gap cut through.
Now, the legal question for you, paragraph 108, we've discussed whether it might be preferable to go to approve the third zone, but on the moment that you advance this proposition that making conditional on a outline master plan approval Does that come into conflict with the environmental declaration decisions on the Auckland framework provisions that ultimately led to Kirkpatrick's team to withdraw all of those provisions out of the unitary plan?
Is this on basis of an outline development plan as known for the people which can see this conditional?
Correct.
Yes. Yes, if you make the activity subdivision and make it a requirement so that you've got an activity and make it a requirement that the subdivision be part of that subdivision consent, you have to provide a structure plan in accordance with the structure plan that's provided with the council and what will be considered in line with criteria.
Thank you. I suppose the last question of principle that what I've discussed with you is it realistic to go down the track that you are advocating and Mr. Christian is supporting, where we don't know where the access will be, we don't know what conditions of the access will be, and that is this all too conditional? In effect, is this premature?
I don't think it is. I don't think it is at all. Because Mr. Neville has reconsidered the only options that would be available, just in terms of the potential available connections. And he's assessed that in light of what is the known, and that is the likely traffic generation from a yield of 150. And his view is that, you know, if you've got two external connections, they can cope. And it's really no difference, and I think the point is that it's really no difference to the connections within his summary evidence to the situation in Northlake, where we've got land that is balanced land that is not yet subject to the structure plan, an open plan, where the plan doesn't indicate where those external road connections will be. That's yet to be decided, and it will happen within the context of a later ODP or subdivision consent context.
Thank you. Steve? Anybody doing the QCE person or just see that thing? Well, should we hear from Spirit?
Thank you very much. Oh, Spirit, what are you going to say?
I don't know
if there's any evidence.
Just a question to you. What would you have to ask for the QCE?
So we did just start the Austrian settlements on Stevenson in Christchurch, so they came to Christchurch. And one of the issues we did talk about was that, so they are investigating access issues themselves at this moment. And they're working on some other valuation work, and other items for the work from the RTOs.
Thank you. To you and your fellow beneficiaries is to the economic return to general sector.
Yes, that is true.
Here's the point, but if you haven't got that, you haven't got either. So, I'll this question because of my colleague, Commissioner Cloud, who had asked it. He might be assumed that he was representing the views of council, whereas I certainly don't represent the views of council. If this is solely a matter of economic concern, you just said for yourself, but do you think the beneficiaries would be able to sell the land of council?
I think to be honest, in any transaction for sale is to sell a property to whoever the best buyer would be for any property. And the Queenstown Leadership Council is one of those parties that have done that test.
And the reason I pose that question is because we were discussing Section 85 of the Act, which is the provision that says that if land is not able to be subject to reasonable use, which means economic qualifications, a reasonable economic use, not necessarily the optimum use, but a reasonable economic use. One of the remedies open to the Environment Court in that case is to direct, providing the landowner agrees, sale to the district council. It's one way option. The council has no choice. The landowners have a choice as to whether they agree or not. But it's a public works act process. I noticed you said quite carefully that you would look for an effect. I don't mean it's pejorative, it's what anyone would say. The highest and best offer you could give. If it were a choice from a public works act process, which is both sides control, an objectively framed test, would you be open to that? I'm not asking you to commit yourself, but can I ask like that? Because I know you can't speak for your fellow beneficiaries, and it wouldn't be fair for me to put you on the spot, but I'm trying to get an indication of your view as to how we best solve this conundrum.
Well, I don't understand. I keep on the word that the one of the certain rules can come from to achieve those sorts of things. I can't face anyone else. I guess that if that's to assist the bank test or the economic benefit, the owners are able to make that decision. But I imagine it would be a last resort from the owner's point of view.
How many of the beneficiaries do you actually have are you actually in communication with? I know there's over 1,000 names, but in terms of the pool of people you actually know where they are and who they are.
So I suppose the process for me starting to do that reporting, and we have an initial list which is around 1,000 people. That number's grown to possibly 1,300 there.
So
1,300?
Very possible.
And that's because there's been more work commissioned by the Murray Land Court, who's no longer in existence at the moment. I believe they're human trafficking, but they have identified more owners over the past 12 months. We recently obtained a list of all those owners. Previously, the Murray Land Court's never refused to share any contact or details of those people, purely just shareholding their name. But we've now managed to gain access to the addresses of probably 1,200 people, maybe 1,100 of them, which has allowed us now, I've just set up a website, and we will be sending information to all the 100 people that access that website to understand more about the land, the process, and keep them up to date with events such as today. So that's this has been funded through CBK, which is in conjunction with the Austria Centers. So right up to now, I probably had contact with a dozen or so of the larger shareholders with a number of based in Crossbridge. But there's been really over the last 7 years, I believe, run by the Austria Centers, and we're on plan for July for the owners to get together. And as you can appreciate, they are far as possible.
Well, so we're on the road, obviously. To what extent do you have any, like, I understand the careful qualification of your efforts to be lost in the beneficiaries as a whole, and that makes perfect sense given when you just said to what extent, do you think that you have a feel for what the beneficiaries might ultimately seek? Or is it just a way out there?
I think through this process, I've come to understand or unearth a lot of the history and the restrictions of the land has. And I guess the major shareholders that I've shared that information with, they will tend to support the process that I'm going through because they now understand some of the information provided, a lot of the information has come from the evidence we've provided, and they see that my submission is a clear path forward and is likely to be a favourite option. But we still need to be quite transparent with those owners and provide them with the other four or five other options. But as times progress, those other options have become a little more challenging.
What
the other options were potentially forestry, it might have been some recreational, it may have been also in the form of some sort of joint venture arrangement, developing the land ourselves, or selling the property. So there were a number of options, and this information was provided 18 months ago to all of the shareholders, beneficiaries, but that's really as far as the amount of information that's on the website as well. So they'll go to, and that'll be updated as we move forward.
It's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So, commissioners. Just an open thing for we obviously how grateful our family has been using your land for a few decades. The community has been using your land for a few decades, rightly or wrongly, that happened. But it's just to express absolute gratitude for the work that you've allowed us to use and fully acknowledge that it's yours and the extended disposal of right you wish. That's the right, the private land, but yeah, and not only thank you on behalf of yourself and the community, but also the international community. Thank you very much, sir. Good question.
We'll be back at 12:30.
Thank you very much.